Kevin Sheehan and I met back in 2018 and quickly ended up working together for over 2 years. Kevin founded and leads Hope Collaborative, a nonprofit that works to make outstanding leadership development a standard for youth, that's right, youth, living in under-resourced neighborhoods in over 7 countries. Additionally, Kev is an award-winning entrepreneur, author, and philanthropist. Our session took some wild turns discussing leadership philosophy and even spirituality, music metaphors, and how children can model learning and exploration for adult leaders. As always, it was fun talking to Kevin, and here's our conversation. Kevin Sheehan from Hope Collaborative and Leader Jam. Great to see you. Thanks for joining me on the Nonprofiteers podcast.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Yeah. So, you know, we worked together for several years on Leader Jam, and I feel like I already know you pretty well. Yeah, it was fantastic. But everyone out there doesn't know you.
Yeah.
And what you're doing with Hope Collaborative particularly, which is your nonprofit. So
yeah, really appreciate you doing this series on nonprofit leaders. What a neat approach to educating people about what's going on. And so, yeah, we started Hope Collaborative as a mission to deliver free leadership education to kids living in under-resourced neighborhoods around the world. And it really came out of a series of conversations that I had with some partners who are established business people in Boston. And there was a recognition. I had written a book on leadership for a new generation, featuring some of the great leaders of the last 100 years and how they became who they were. And there was a general acknowledgement among us in this informal group at the time that leadership quality was critical to the success of an individual, to the success of an organization, to the success of a community, of a school. And then we all said, okay, so if that matters, why wouldn't we have leadership education in areas where they're struggling economically? I mean, it seems to be pretty intuitive. And that was the beginning. One of the first operational questions we had was, well, why don't we just help the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts do what they do, but now in new places? What we realized in the discovery was that you need a certain infrastructure to run a Boy Scout troop that places that don't have the infrastructure can't have.
Right.
So for most, you know, young people, when they're lucky and they get leadership modeling from parents or scout leaders, it's somewhat peripheral to their education. You know, the schools struggle getting you math and English and social studies and French or whatever you're studying, because the budgets are so tight. The idea of then doing leadership development too is generally too much. So that was our mission. And we've since worked with over 250 schools around the world in 7+ countries and touched some many thousands of kids through a process of, we built a 4-year curriculum in collaboration with Mass General Hospital's Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds, and then rolled it out by training trainers in the institutions to do the teaching. Early on, we did teaching ourselves, but it's more of a viral and increasingly becoming an online program that we're running to teach the trainers how to do it.
One of the things I love about Hope Collaborative is that it runs against the conventional idea that leadership is something for adults. And, you know, that might be an implicit idea. I think if you think about it for a minute, it's, you know, leadership incorporates a huge number of things which are great for people of any age: emotional intelligence, mindfulness, you know, all kinds of qualities. And
yeah,
you know, why not get to kids as early as possible?
So the early on in the build, we ran into experts who said, look, it may be, and they were acknowledging a hypothesis that we were kind of testing. They said it may be that kids of a certain age aren't conceptual enough to do things that are about leadership, because leadership is more conceptual than learning to read, right? And so that was a good hypothesis. So what we did was we fortunately succeeded with high school kids and then middle school kids. And some of the schools and institutions asked if we could do fifth graders, at which point I kind of gasped and said, you know, I don't know, that could be interesting. This was actually at the Islamist Center in Boston, and I was teaching at the time because it was local, and I was able to get into the classroom, which was helpful in developing a program. And so the kids really took to it, of all ages, but the fifth graders, I remember one kid with big eyes, you know, and he was always a kid wanting to jump in and very bright. Mm-hmm. And we did, we were in the midst of a module on conflict resolution.
Yeah.
And the model we were teaching was, you know, fight or flight, the natural human tendency in a collision of personality or people is to either run or fight. And so anyway, we did a 45-minute art piece on how they thought about it. And at the end of the class, he waved his hand. He said, you know, Mr. Kevin, can I jump in? I said, yeah, sure. He said, I think we've gone from fight or flight to work it out together. And I said, wow. You know, I think fifth graders can get this. And by the way, you now have your PhD thesis and your first book.
Yeah.
Keep going.
There you go. There you go. I mean, to use a music metaphor, and both of us love those, you know, people think that kids can't be exposed to jazz at a young age in favor of three chord ditties. Nothing wrong with the three chord ditties. You know, we all, you and I particularly love the blues, but kids are capable of so much more than I think we give them credit for. And getting to them early, you know, they're in the sponge stage. So they really absorb things that stick for long periods of time.
No, that's right. I mean, modeling and embodying are core components of learning. Kids are very visual. They watch their mom. They watch their dad. They repeat what they see and what they hear. Right. I mean, ask Miles Davis's parents if he liked jazz as an 8-year-old. Probably get an interesting answer.
Exactly. Exactly. So early on in the Hope Collaborative stages of development, what were some of the challenges you faced that were memorable and difficult?
Yeah. I mean, you and I have been in software too. The hardest part are the first three paying customers, right? We gift our program at Hope. We also charge for it, but to schools that have the resource. But getting those first customers, getting those first users is hard. I remember a year when a neighbor who was a friend and a big impact at the beginning of the business, Khaled, he has a Middle Eastern name from Saudi, was really helpful. And he and I were driving around the city talking to parish priests and middle school principals, you know, trying to get the first bites. And it was the first, you know, people who jumped on who were really the heroes in the whole thing. And, you know, Steve Jobs famously said, there's a great series of quotes in interviews. He said, you've got to be so passionate about what you do because it's totally irrational and so hard, right? That if you don't have kind of overwhelming passion, you're going to give up for good reason.
Absolutely.
I just finished Bruce Springsteen's memoir, and there are scenes where he's sandwiched in a van between the guys in the back and the guys driving to California to do gigs as they were developing the band. And he basically said, I had to survive being sandwiched in this metal van for like 7 hours at a time to realize the dream. I mean, most people would say, we're
not going to do it.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great insight. So how did you stoke your passion in those early days, you know, so that you weren't discouraged or you didn't feel like quitting and doing something else, which you probably could have easily done?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we talked about spirit and leadership. For me, it's really about connecting to the inner energy and the inner intuition and following kind of your muse. Mm-hmm. So to go back to music, and then I'll talk more about our personal experience. I happened to know John Coltrane's wife, who became a good friend, Alice. She was the keyboard player in the band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we talked about a story when she was alive and we were together in California about, and I asked her, I had written about it in a book and I'd read a lot about this moment, but I wanted her perspective. Mm-hmm. There was a famous moment. He was in a club and he was soloing, and it was the keyboard player's moment to solo. And he turned to the keyboard player, but he kept playing. And he walked off the stage and into the men's room and kept playing. And then he came back on the stage. And so everyone thought, you know, nature calls for everybody. And I guess John had to go to the bathroom, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Interviewed him about, they asked him about it. And he said, I was so alive in the solo that I couldn't put it down. I had to... Mm-hmm. find the truth in what I was playing. And I wanted, you know, my keyboard player, Alice, to do her solo. And I needed a place where I could do it without people hearing me. So, and of course, yeah, they still heard him through the walls. But I think it's that power of discovering what's possible and mm-hmm. building on it. And then the yeah. journey with the people. I mean, I think having great people with you who give of themselves and who reveal who they are along the way, and you can mm-hmm. really reveal yourself to them. And,
yeah.
And that you grow as a team and as people, and that's what makes life worthwhile, right?
Yeah. The story about John Coltrane is so interesting, and I think you mentioned that to me earlier, just like I mentioned a George Benson story, which I'm going to tell you in a minute.
Please.
The interesting thing there for me is not just giving yourself the space to discover and taking risks, which that was a micro example, right?
Yes.
It's also, and this might be the difference between the John Coltranes and the not John Coltranes, is knowing, you know, who you are and what you were meant to do. You know, to me, that's a very powerful idea. And there's discovery involved there. The George Benson story is, I read an article about him. This was decades ago. And the interviewer asked him, when did you decide to become a guitar player? And he goes, oh, I never decided. It wasn't like I'll do this or I'll be a wallpaper hanger or a fireman yeah. or whatever. It's all I ever wanted to do. You know, mm-hmm. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd play. And then I'd eat something. Then I'd play some more. And then I'd eat something. Then I'd look for a gig. Then I'd play some more. It's all he ever wanted to do. Yeah, he knew what his...
For like yeah. 11 hours a day.
Yeah.
All consuming, yeah. right? And
yeah.
I mean, the spiritualists and the mystic people, you know, will tell you that the journey inward to the universe and the universal mm-hmm. energies, you know, is endless. That it's, mm-hmm. you don't, I remember Alice telling me she had an ashram in Agoura Hills, California. And on Sundays, the great African-American musicians from the neighborhood would come and jam with her. And I happened to be there with my wife when she was pregnant, and we were able to hang out and be part of it. And mm-hmm. and Alice would solo and take you to places that were beyond this world. And,
right.
and the musicians participated. But then she would talk and she said, you know, you think of the spirit journey as, you know, you pass away and then there's kind of heaven and a big banquet and it all comes to some ending. And she said, it's eternal. It goes on forever. You continually build,
right?
You continually make this happen. So the notion that George Benson as a very young guy was doing it might be a progression of energy, right?
Yeah.
This energy that arrives from wherever he was doing it before, doing it again and doing it, you know, beyond this place. And I think I've been thinking a lot lately about the relationship between work and self. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you said the whole thing in life and several great philosophers have said, know thyself. So, mm-hmm. you know, finding out who you are and the work that you do has an interesting relationship. And I think they inform each other, right?
Absolutely. They're self-reinforcing.
They're self-reinforcing. You wake up yeah. with a new song you're writing and your self impacts it and it impacts self. You yeah. wake up to the work with kids in, you know, Spirit and is one of our partners in Africa. And, you know, I remember teaching their teachers in a church. We were on Zoom, the three of us, and they had 20 people in the pews learning this education process, and it just woke me up for a week. I mean, I was like, yeah. ah, you know, and the meaning of those relationships and that work, and that we had reached that far at that point, it was kind of a milestone. And so,
you know, what's interesting to me about what you said, a couple of things, a lot of things. There are a lot of false dichotomies. The idea of an inner journey versus the outer journey mm-hmm. is one of them. You know, exploring yourself is exploring the world as mm-hmm. well. And it opens you up to the world. It makes you generally more open and vulnerable to begin with. So, you know, that there's nothing selfish or wasteful about that inner journey and figuring out who you are.
Yeah. I've been just, you know, consistent with nothing. I've been reading interviews of Tom Waits lately, and he has this incredible ability to animate physical things and how he talks about the world, you know, and, mm-hmm. and he creates these vivid metaphors about, you know, the physical world and, you know, wrote a song called "The Piano's Been Drinking, My Necktie's Asleep" is the lyric. You know,
yeah.
The combo went back to New York. The jukebox had to take in the bathroom, right? but he described this inner outer connection in the interview. That's how he mm-hmm. lives in the world, you know.
Yeah,
and I think as it relates to nonprofit leaders, you know, there are times I think you're working in real economic stress. And you mm-hmm. say that about a lot of business people. I mean, 65% of the country's businesses, according to friends of mine at Harvard Business School, are family businesses. And they go, you know, they accordion, you know, up and down. And nonprofit leaders kind of famously can struggle, and then it can go great. You can have a lot of resource.
Yeah.
But I think it's irrelevant of the physical circumstance, right? Mm-hmm. That journey to the meaning of what you're doing and to yourself happens whether you're in a cave in the Himalayas or sitting on a throne in some wealthy kingdom. You know,
right.
You're alone in your meaning journey and in your connection to self. Mm-hmm. And you can see that as a trap and very hard, or you can see that as magnificent and endless and a gift to
right.
the universal energies that animate us, right?
Yeah. I think the boundless thing is as you learn more about yourself. And I just wrote this, I just did this quick tip video and wrote this quick article about self-care, which has been over-talked about. And the focus of the article was, why don't people, everyone talks about self-care, healthy eating, exercise, sleeping right, blah, blah, blah. Why don't people take care of themselves, right? And one of the reasons is they can't get started. But a big, surprising big reason is they think they don't have time, or they think that it's selfish. They think that it's, you know, that strong people devote themselves completely to other people, right? And that to me is kind of a crazy notion, because learning right. about yourself and learning about your connection to the external world only improves all of your relationships and all of your work, all of your productivity, all of that.
Right. I mean, they think it's a waste of time. as they scream at their children and denigrate the domestic culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where if you can learn a framework of dealing with the kids that has you not screaming, you create so much more space.
Yeah.
One exercise that I love giving meditation audiences, and I know you teach mindfulness and meditation in a bunch of places, including, I think, Berkeley College. One thing I say to folks at the end is, okay, here's one assignment. First, we challenge the group. What percentage of the day do you worry? Are your thoughts in a negative modality, right? And you'll get everything from 10% to 100%. And God bless the people who are carrying 100%, you know. But the question is, if you're 100%, how do you get to 90? If you're 80, right, how do you get to 75?
Mm-hmm.
And what we know about nonprofits and leadership and the work is your ability to ideate and plan for success directly correlates with your success.
Absolutely.
So you have to have the time to not only envision, but bring the energy of progress to progress. And if you're tied up in worry, you're not going to do that. So the more fuel you can give your day in the space and openness of productive thinking and positive connection, the more success you're going to be. So the problem I think people have, and this gets into the great books, Tiny Habits and Atomic Habits, and there are a couple of them, but the wonderful kind of discovery is you don't have to go from 80 to 10. You need to go from 80 to 79, and then from 79 to 78.
Yeah, and that builds self-efficacy.
Yeah, and it's a cycle, right? It has momentum about it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the natural health energy overcomes the negative energy because it has to, right? It's like, you know, they describe if you walk into a dark haunted house with a candle, it's like magic.
Mm-hmm.
But the candle's tiny compared to the dark house, right?
Right. Right. What you call worry, I call background noise. It can be any kind of emotional disturbance that's pulling you away from what's right in front of you.
That's right.
It is a positive feedback loop. The more you become aware of that, realize how destructive it is, realize how it displaces being present and joy and other things you need to be a great leader. If you're able to manage it a little bit, you're able to focus on other stuff, and that creates positive energy, right? And there's less time with the negative. So the toxic glass starts to empty, or the empty glass starts to fill with the good stuff. Whatever, pick your metaphor, but it is, you know, if you can do a little bit and practice it. So that brings me to another question for you is in this increasingly secular world, you know, and I, as you probably know, I'm not a theist. Atheist is still a dirty word because people don't really understand what that means. So I'm just going to say I'm not a theist, but I'm still a spiritual person. Mm-hmm. How do you bring spirituality into your leadership? What would you, if you were talking to a young nonprofit leader, what would you say to them about the spiritual dimension? Because you've done a lot of this work, and I think it's underrepresented or kind of improperly represented in leadership circles.
Right. So Buzz Aldrin, who, you know, piloted the Eagle with Neil Armstrong, and they asked him about teamwork. And of course, he was on one of the most famous teams in history. And I love what he said. He said, teamwork is 90% self-preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just break it down. Teamwork is 90% self-preparation, right? So when you ask about spirit and leadership, it really is advancing the self power, the spirit power in your yoga practice, in your meditation practice, in your connection to nature, if you're Frank Lloyd Wright, in, you know, however you find that energy.
Mm-hmm.
Advance the energy and amplify it, and then show up with the team for the work,
mm-hmm.
right? It's, you know, my favorite meditation that a friend of mine shared with me, and it came to him in an inner meditation, but it's beautiful. It said, and this, I think this connects the human with the theistic godly component, right? When you experience peace, expand the peace. Mm-hmm. When you experience joy, expand joy. When you experience love, expand the love. And when you do those things, you expand me.
Right.
Right. So where you find the time in the space and the places to do that work, you're naturally expanding the greater me and then bringing it into the leadership component. One other thing on it that I've been really awakened to in the last year is, and you might have seen some of this literature, but there's a book by Adam Grant, maybe, about learning as the competitive edge.
Right.
So his basic thesis is that it's really not talent, it's not hard work alone. You got to have the body of Michael Jordan to win in the NBA, but it's the ability to learn how to learn.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said recently, there's some character on television in a police drama, and at the end of all his meetings with the team in the morning before they hit the streets, he would say, "All right, everybody, get out there and learn something today."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So your audience may not know that you're a great guitar player. And why are you a great guitar player when somebody who started at the same time with a similar guitar, you know, might have stopped? Not only didn't become a good guitar player, but might have stopped. And what the new research is saying is it's because you were able to learn how to learn the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you learn how to learn the guitar, you become a faster learner. Mm-hmm. And then in a competitive kind of matrix, you move up much faster than everybody else because they're stuck on not knowing how to learn.
Right.
And I think it's not about people's limits of learning so much as we don't focus on that.
Right. 100% agree. Absolutely. It's not, you know, you don't talk about that. We go right to the subject material itself and not what's the best way to absorb that. And by the way, the answer is different for different kinds of people with different preferences and different mindsets, right? And, you know, that is in some curriculums part of leadership training is, you know, how do you learn? How do you open yourself up to new experiences? How do you figure out what your preferences are for absorbing information or absorbing experience? That's something also that kids ought to get early on. And I've always thought that if kids got that, they would be so much more clear in high school and in college what they wanted to do in life, what they wanted to explore.
Well, and you said two things. One is open yourself up to experiences.
Mm-hmm.
What happens for people is they feel shameful or embarrassed because they have no idea how to hit the golf ball.
Yeah.
But your point is, if you open yourself up to the golf club and the tee and the ball, that is the first victory, right? That's the beginning of learning. Yeah. And knowing that is part of it is really important, right? And the second thing that you said, you know, is that learning is iterative, but more important in my view, the best educators have taught me that it's developing a kid's point of view. That's education.
Yes. Right.
It's not
right.
Knowing facts or knowing skills or knowing the tools of being an electrician. It's, I have a perspective on being an electrician and I think about it this way and it's valuable and it could be considered genius because it's a framework above all others. But regardless of where it fits, it's my perspective that I'm going to develop because I was given this neurological set of patterns that's different than anybody else's. And when you lace that over your experience set, which Bill Gates said is the unique qualifier that will never let AI take over the planet, because everybody's experience is different, completely different, right?
Yeah.
7 billion people having all of these moments that they're kind of bringing together. But for a kid and educators and learners, you got to really want and respect and honor your point of view. I remember a college professor who changed my life. I was dumb enough to take a Faulkner seminar as an English major. I was sitting with guys in the class who were like, this is the third time I've read Absalom, Absalom. And I'm 20. I'm on page 30. But I remember the prof basically, to make it a shorter story, said, I honor your point of view. You have a valuable point of view. And it so happened that at the end of the class, he asked me to sign a release that he could use a couple ideas in his PhD thesis. And I remember thinking, you know, maybe my point of view on this crazy Southern guy, you know, in Yakima County matters, you know, and maybe I have a point of view. A lot of people aren't taught that they have a point of view. We had one kid kind of tragically in a group in Boston, you know, his dad, the theme in his house or apartment, wherever they lived, was you will not graduate the eighth grade. Wow. That was the theme, right?
Wow.
Imagine growing up with that expectation and perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately, without naming him, he went, you know, well beyond, and hopefully with our program, it helped. But acknowledging, well, great teachers, they say, see the child, and being seen by the teacher unleashes things that are explosive in somebody if it's done well.
Yeah. That idea of seeing the child for teachers extends to yourself. You know, do you see yourself, and do you see yourself with empathy and with openness? And the other thing that was triggered was the idea of how people are resistant to learning and resistant to looking silly. You mentioned the golf example. One of my heroes, Shunryu Suzuki, who's one of the people who brought Zen Buddhism to the West, said, in the beginner's mind, the possibilities are endless. In the expert's mind, there are none, right? So it's good to be a beginner. That's one of the things we can learn from kids. Mm-hmm. It's good to have that. And it's good not to be ashamed and not to feel like, hey, I'm taking up golf and I'm 59 years old or 67, whatever. So what? Just have fun, you know?
And that's a perspective on pivoting, right?
Yeah.
So Kash Rangan, who built the social enterprise curriculum at Harvard Business School, is a friend of mine from decades. And I was with him in his office, and he wrote a recent article on pivoting. And his research showed that social entrepreneurs who, and call them nonprofit leaders too, you know, just put them all in a bucket, who pivot in response to the feedback are doing the work. That is the work.
Right.
To learn, innovate, and pivot, right? So without getting into the for-profit that you and I work on, we made a pivot because of friction, we pivoted into a new model. And at the beginning of that process, it felt like, well, why don't we go bang our head against the wall and fix this old model? Let's keep tinkering and fixing it. And then through an input from an advisor and some creative meetings, we were like, this new thing is so much more efficient. and it relates to the old thing, but this may be the solution to tinkering.
Yeah.
The pivots actually are the answers. A friend of mine said, it was really great. We had an intransigent member of the team, and I was talking to this guy and said, what do I do that they won't go along with the change in the evolution? He said, well, say this. If it's raining, would you put up an umbrella to not get wet? So we either put up an umbrella or we're going to get wet. It's one or the other.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you and I have talked about the VUCA world. We live in volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Yeah.
You know, modern leaders need to be able to pivot. And to be able to pivot, you need to be able to accept change. And you also need to be able to recognize the pivot conditions, you know, the conditions that are right in front of you that will. So again, openness required. And learning is something that the ability to learn and the passion for learning is something that enables the pivot, right?
Yeah, you remind me of, there's a theory of the 5X employee.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about pivots for a minute. So I often think about it like if you're a chef, I know you cook and I do too. You know, you may be making bolognese pasta, whatever, but you're kind of flirting with a little cream sauce thing on the side to just try it. Mm-hmm. You got it. A good model in life is to have a few things kind of simmering for long periods of time in the background. Who knows if they'll ever go anywhere, right? Because it takes time for everything to kind of show itself. So you may as well kind of brew things at a slow rate in the background. So the employee research shows now that when you build a company, a nonprofit, you want to hire what they call 5X employees. And the point of 5X employees is a 1X employee is somebody who comes to the office and wants absolute clarity about what they're going to deliver after the end of 5 days. They want to do one or two things well. They want to do them over and over for 25 years, and they want to go home, which is fine. I mean, that, you know, Ford assembly plant model from all those years ago. Mm-hmm. A 5X employee wants to do her job, but also, you know, learn the financial frameworks that are driving this, and they want to get involved in picking the new app for the lunchroom, and they want to, you know, try to help you fix the vending machine. And, you know, they just want to be 5X. They like learning and getting involved. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Cash's pivot model and the 5X model I just described kind of coalesce in the culture of learning, Amy Edmondson's, you know, culture of learning model that fuels really productive teams and success. You know, in the meantime, the other part of all this is that being a nonprofit leader is isolating and hard work. I'm always amazed that, you know, the donation amounts in nonprofit world are much less than the, you know, the investment size that people make in the for-profit world.
Right.
By a factor of 10 to 30. Yeah. But there are people doing nonprofit social impact work that has big impact, you know, the kind of fix the problem before it happens.
Right.
You know, the best research from Nick Christakis, who's a good friend of mine from childhood.
Yeah.
Now at Yale is.
Yeah.
You got to have the resources in place for people as a community to succeed.
Right.
You can't bootstrap. And I read a book recently that said the bootstrap metaphor is ridiculous because if you reach down to pull on your bootstraps, you can't lift yourself up. I mean, the metaphor itself is flawed, right?
Terrible, terrible metaphor. Terrible overused metaphor. And terrible.
Yeah. People need each other and they need inputs. You know, they need the loan from the uncle to make it to the degree in college. They need the GI Bill coming out of the military and World War to become who they were. And honestly, we're always giving each other legs up. I mean, it's how we live as a
community. Absolutely. So, yeah, one of the biggest issues for leaders who want to delegate that don't do it well is they don't invest enough in training and resources for the employee that they're delegating to.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
How can you become what you want me to be if we don't learn?
There you go.
And that extends to coaching, right?
Absolutely.
The coaching culture, people don't stop the action and help each other learn.
Yeah. So, boy, this went exactly the way I thought it would. You and I could keep talking for hours and hours.
Yeah, I got to drive north and hang out with you more.
Yeah, I know. And not that far north either. So, we're both in the Boston area. So some of this is probably surfaced, but to congeal it, if you were going to give three pieces of leadership advice to a young nonprofit leader, what would you tell them?
The first thing is, you know, decide if it's a passion or a business. I have a friend who runs a program for kids, and he and his wife deliver Christmas gifts to kids who won't get them every year, and they do it out of a warehouse, and it's relatively informal, and it brings them so much joy. And it brings the kids, and it's this really powerful model. That's great. Go do that. Or start a business where you have employees. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I talk to people a lot about the economics of devotion, and I work with people around the world who run organizations based on volunteerism. I really believe that it shouldn't be about money when you're helping people without money. It should be about service.
Absolutely.
That's number one. Number two, and this is unfortunate what I'm going to say, the big solutions are the place to put your energy and resource as a society. So find the nonprofits that are doing things highly effectively and then grow those, right? Go where the going is good because the numbers are happening. So if you're in that mindset, try to figure out technology solutions, efficiency solutions that can scale just like a good software company, because that scale and numbers and flow is what the market of business nonprofits is looking for these days. Mm-hmm. I loved a quote from Ben Franklin in the Ken Burns, Ben Franklin documentary, mm-hmm. where he said, the greatest act of social enterprise, and he had different words for it back in the day, but he said, is a product that helps people live better. And it's great. And it may be, you know, I remember in the 90s, there was the rainforest effort, but then the iPad comes and who saved more trees? Steve Jobs or people funding not cutting down trees. Now, they both may have had an impact, but Jobs saved a whole lot of trees with the iPad, right? So that's kind of number two is, you know, you may want to go into scaled impact, right? Once you determine passion or business, you may want to go into scaled impact. And the third thing I think that's important, and we've talked about it along the way, is constant innovation. Mm-hmm. You know, you're always fighting to stay alive and thrive, and that means staying ahead of the curve and innovating. Now, there are two kinds of nonprofits in this third bucket or in any of the buckets. They're hand-tailored delivered services like Perkins School for the Blind is a famous Hallmark place 3 miles from here that work with kids who are blind, and it's high touch.
Right?
Yeah. In a business setting, you and I would call that job shop, right? Every job is new. Every kid is new, right? And then there's scalable, you know, things that you can deliver at increasing scale. And I think you got to decide which of those you want to be a part of, and both have great impact and can be highly meaningful, mm-hmm. but they're very different to walk right. into a school with 1,000 students, all who need attention and tailored delivery, versus I've got a new app that allows impaired people to hear traffic signals better. You know, that yeah. may be scalable, right? So yeah. that's the third set of decisions to make. And then, you know, I think the final part, I guess this is a fourth part, is whether you do it for a day or a year or a decade. I mean, you know, if you're impacting people in positive ways, you know, God bless and do it, and do it as much as you can, whether you're in a nonprofit or not.
Yeah, I love those. And a couple of them, particularly the first one, is very common. You know, find your passion, figure out what that is, because running a nonprofit is hard. That will carry you through, just like John Coltrane's passion for music carried him through, I'm sure, some difficult periods. And the hardcore jazzers like George Benson and Coltrane, they weren't making money hand over fist in the early days.
Yeah.
So, but the passion was there. So that overrides everything. And that's a great backdrop to have.
Well, and George Benson, to your earlier point, couldn't do anything but play the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been so great talking to you, because this is a, you know, we explored a dimension which is not very often explored. Usually we talk about fundraising or principles of leadership, which are good. All that's good. But this was unusual and outside the conventional topic area. So I'm very grateful that we were able to spend time together. And thank you for your time, Kevin.
Yeah, really good to be with you. And nonprofiteering, keep it going.
Yeah, I will. One final question for you, for people who watch this. What's the best way to plug in to Hope Collaborative?
So go to hopecollaborative.com, and okay. there are ways of donating, there are ways of volunteering, there are ways of
great.
Bringing the curriculum into a school.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, Kevin, good to see you.
Thanks,
Take care of yourself.
See you always.
Okay, bye-bye.